here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Welcome to Evening Under Lamplight, as we make the shift from Kipper the cat, who wasn't here, but his surrogates were, and come out at the other end of the news. And what news it was, folks. Did you like it? Yes. Yes. Evening Under Lamplight, with Robert Louis Abrahamson, and, of course, you know, this is Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. And also, of course, you know, you are invited to attend. This evening, under lamplight, we followed Dante and Virgil down to the ditch containing, well, I'm not sure how to describe them. Traditionally, it's called the ditch or bolgia of the sorcerers. Dante focuses our attention on the soothsayers or fortune tellers, but I think there's a lot more going on than that, as I hope we'll see. Or we can call this the area for magicians of all kinds. And let's jump this early into a song. If you're looking for any kind of magic commodity or service, there are places you can go to. You could have gone to see Neil Henry at Covent Garden, where he, my son the Barrow Boy, ran a stall selling magic things until he moved on. Or you can go to the shop of J.W. Wells and Co., family sorcerers, dealers in magic and spells in Gilbert and Sullivan's The Sorcerer, whose shop was at number 70 Simmeriacs or St. Maryacs, around the spot where the Gherkin now stands. John Wellington Wells' song is a patter song. That means it's sung quickly with a sparkling succession of rhymes. And no one, I think, does it better than John Reed of the Doily Cart Company.
My name is John Wellington Wells. I'm a dealer in magic and spells, in blessings and curses and everfield purses, in prophecies, witches and knells. If you want a proud foe to make tracks, if you'd melt a rich uncle in wax, you've but to look in on our resident gin number 70 Simmeriacs. We've a first-rate assortment of magic, and for raising a posthumous shade, with effects that are comic or tragic, there's no cheaper house in the trade. Love filters with quantities of it, and for knowledge if anyone burns, we're keeping a very small profit, a profit who brings us unbounded returns. For it can prophesy with the wink of his eye, security into futurity, sum up your history, clear up a mystery, humor, proclivity, foreign nativity, foreign nativity. He has answers oracular, bogus spectacular, tetrapods tradical, mirrors some magical, facts astronomical, solemn or comical, and if you want it, he makes a reduction on taking a quantity. Oh, if anyone anything lacks, he'll find it already in stacks, if he'd only look in on the resident gin number 70 Simmeriacs. Can raise you hosts of ghosts, and that without reflectors, and creepy things with wings, and gaunt and grisly specters. He can fill you crowds of shrouds, and horrify you vastly. He can wreck your brains with chains, and gibberings grim and ghastly. Then if you planety changes organity with an urbanity full of satanity, fixes humanity with an inanity fatal to vanity, driving your foes to the verge of insanity. Barring tautology, in demonology, electrobiology, mystricnosology, spirit philology, hydrous astrology, such is his knowledge, he isn't a man to require an apology. My name is John Wellington Wells. I'm a dealer in magic and spells, in blessings and curses, in ever-filled purses, in prophecies, witches and knells. And if anyone anything lacks, he'll find it already in stacks, if he'd only look in on the resident gin number 70 Cimmeriax.
Did you catch the words? No, of course not. It's not easy, especially the first few times you hear one of these patter songs. But they're wonderfully witty. And if you'll indulge me, I'll go over the words slightly less rapidly. Oh, my name is John Wellington Wells. I'm a dealer in magic and spells, in blessings and curses, and ever-filled purses, in prophecies, witches, and knells. If you want a proud foe to make tracks, if you'd melt a rich uncle in wax so you can inherit his money, you've but to look in on our resident djinn or genie, Number 70 Cimmeriax. We've a first-rate assortment of magic, and for raising a posthumous shade with effects that are comic or tragic, there's no cheaper house in the trade. Love filters, we've quantities of it. And for knowledge, if anyone burns, we keep an extremely small profit, a profit who brings us unbounded returns. For he can prophesy with a wink of his eye, peep with security into futurity, sum up your history, clear up a mystery, humor proclivity for a nativity. He has answers oracular, bogeys spectacular, tetrapods tragical, mirrors so magical, facts astronomical, solemn or comical, and if you want it, he makes a reduction on taking a quantity. Oh, if anyone anything lacks, he'll find it already in stacks, if he'll only look in on the resident djinn, number 70, Cimmeriax. A little more? He can raise you hosts of ghosts, and that without reflectors. No phony mirror effects here. And creepy things with wings, and gaunt and grisly spectres. He can fill you crowds of shrouds, and horrify you vastly. He can rack your brains with chains, and gibberings grim and ghastly. Then if you plan it, he changes organity with an urbanity full of satanity, vexing humanity with an inanity fatal to vanity, driving your foes to the verge of insanity. That's eight rhymes for anity. And then here comes another list of eight three-syllable rhymes. But in tautology, on demonology, electrobiology, mystic nosology, spirit philology, high-class astrology, such is his knowledge, he isn't the man to require an apology. So that's our wee comic look at sorcery from Gilbert and Sullivan's Sorcerer from about 140 years ago. But Dante, yes, remember him? Let's see what Dante encounters. So now Dante is led to the next ditch in this region of fraud. Io ero già disposto tutto quando a riguardar nello scoperto fondo che si bagnava d'agno scioso pianto. All eagerness to see what sights the chasm bathed in tears of anguish would disclose. And we too are eager to see what's coming up next. Well, Dante sees crowds of people coming along the curving ditch, silent, weeping, walking slowly as if in a liturgical procession. Dante notices their faces first, and then looks further down the bodies, and to his horror sees that these bodies are all twisted around, so that although their faces are forward, the rest of them is backwards, in a way that we could never imagine seeing in our world. I think the best word to describe these figures is the Scots word thrawn. Perhaps we'd say thrown out of kilter in English. Thrawn, as in Stevenson's famous story written in Scots, called Thrawn Janet. Janet, who's had dealings with demons, has a thrawn craig, or twisted neck. And then there are those miscreants in J.M. Henderson's Chronicles of Cartdale, described as the deal-begotten, cantankerous, thrawn-in-the-neck, ungrateful pests of society that would far rather gang the wrang road than the right dane. But now, O reader, Dante says, as you hope God will give you good fruit from reading my poem, try to imagine how I could have kept my face dry when I saw up close the human form so twisted that their tears were running down their backs to the buttocks and down into the crack there. Amazing detail. You would cry too if it happened to you. Dante makes a big deal about how horrible this was, how strange and pathetic, and we have to take his word that it really is as bad as he says, but he ain't seen nothing yet. He'll see much worse distortions of the human body as he goes further down. If Dante weeps at the sight of these strange bodies also weeping, then we must be on the alert. Poetically, it would suggest some identification of Dante with these people whose sin we still don't know about. We'll just keep this possible identification in mind as we go on. Maybe it will reveal something to us later on. But Dante's weeping also gets him into immediate trouble. Are you still as stupid as the others? Virgil scolds, and then he gives Dante a line that has aroused a lot of critical discussion. Qui vive la pietà quand è ben morta? It's kind of a pun on the meaning of the word pietà, which can mean in English both piety and pity. Down here, Virgil is saying, piety lives when pity is fully dead. In other words, the appropriate response down here can come only when we no longer pity these figures we see. Dante had, it seemed, pitied these poor souls with their grotesquely distorted bodies, but these twisted people, like all the other people we see in hell, are not real people. They have become embodiments of certain states of the soul. Their shape and actions are to be seen as symbolic representations. Showing sympathy is harmful sentimentality here. So stop your weeping and attend to the figures coming towards us now.
It is time for you to stop all of your sleeping. This is time for you to stop all of your sobbing. There's one. Stop sobbing now, yeah. Stop it, stop it. Stop sobbing now.
Oops, there came the Kinks, echoing Virgil's reprimand to Dante with the opening lines of their song, Stop Your Sobbing, of course. So, as Virgil was telling Dante, stop your sobbing and attend to the figures coming towards us now. And then we get a catalogue of the different people down there, a catalogue that ranges from the heroic Greeks to a few sordid Italians of Dante's time. First, we see Amphiaraus, a great hero in the ancient Greek legends, a prophet who foresaw that he would be killed if he went to the battle besieging Thebes, and he went into hiding instead. But his hiding place was betrayed by his wife, who was bribed, and he was dragged to the war, where indeed he was killed, swallowed up by the earth as he fled from the enemy. He's here because, Virgil says, volse veder troppo davanti. He wanted to see too far ahead into the future. And he did, in fact, see into the future and saw accurately. But this foreknowledge only made him more fearful, as he tried, in vain, to run away from the fate he had rightly foreseen for himself. Oh, look, and there's Tiresias, another famous Greek prophet. It's worth stopping for a second to go over his story, an intriguing and fascinating story. Tiresias, his name means he who delights in signs. Tiresias was walking along one day and saw two snakes copulating. He struck them with his walking stick. Why? Was he embarrassed to see them doing it together? Was he trying to keep the snake population down? Or is this a reference to some obscure magic ritual? Maybe this last, since something magic did occur. Tiresias was immediately transformed into a woman. Did she intend for this to happen? Is Tiresias an avatar for modern transsexuals? Well, whatever secrets lie behind this, Tiresias remained a woman for 7 years until one day she came across the same two snakes, again copulating, struck them with a stick, and immediately was transformed back into a man. Phew, I was getting tired of all that anti-woman discrimination, he might have said, or something. So there we have Tiresias, the classic example of someone who's been both a man and a woman. And next, the story shifts up to Mount Olympus, where one day the king and queen of the gods, Zeus and Hera, were having another quarrel. Hera was furious about the way Zeus was stooping every woman he saw. Let me continue the story as Robert Graves tells it. Zeus defended himself by arguing that, at any rate, when he did share Hera's couch, she had the more enjoyable time by far. Women, of course, derive infinitely greater pleasure from the sexual act than men, he blustered. What nonsense, cried Hera. The exact contrary is the case, and well you know it. Tiresias, summoned to settle the dispute from his personal experience, answered, if the parts of love pleasure be counted as 10, thrice 3 go to women, 1 only to men. In other words, and now we're leaving Robert Graves behind, in other words, women get 9 times more pleasure from sex than men do. Hera was furious by this answer, or perhaps more furious by the sight of Zeus's triumphant smile, and in her anger she blinded Tiresias. But Zeus took pity on him, since after all Tiresias had backed his side of the argument, and Zeus bestowed on him the gift of prophecy. That's one version of the story, there are others. But so Tiresias becomes another archetypal figure, the blind prophet. He can see into the future, though he cannot see what is happening in the present. And in this role, he appears in many other stories, such as Oedipus or Narcissus, as the great prophet who knows all these things hidden from mere mortals.
Thank you.
That was Schumann's Vogel als Prophet, or the Prophet Bird, played by Hideko Utagawa for our blind prophet Tiresias. Next, Virgil points out Aruns, an Etruscan seer, who foretold the future by observing the sea and the stars. After him is Manto, the daughter of Tiresias, and here Dante gives an odd, twisted description. Manto's long hair is going down along her front, hiding her breasts, and so ogni pilo supelle, all her hairy parts are all together on the one side. Virgil stops his catalogue at this point to give Dante a long, twisted story about how Manto wandered around on a twisted journey and finally founded the city of Mantua in a swamp where the twisting river Mincio finally comes to an end. This has a twisted significance since Mantua was Virgil's birthplace, and so he wants to clear up the story once and for all, but in doing this, Virgil has twisted in on himself, since this version contradicts the version he himself gave us in his great poem, The Aeneid. All these twistings here, some of them sinful, some of them truthful. All this, 72 lines, is one of the longest speeches Virgil delivers in the Inferno. Thanks, says Dante, I'll keep this in mind. Oh yeah, and is there anyone else down in this place you think I should take note of? And Virgil is off again, pointing out more prophets, Eurypylus from the time of the Trojan War, and then jumping many centuries. What, look, there's Michael Scott. Che veramente della magia che frodo seppe il gioco, who really knew how to play the game of magic fraud. So here we come across the one Scotsman to be found in the Inferno. This is Michael Scott of Balwearie, whom Villani calls Il Grande Filosofo, the Grand Philosopher, and Boccaccio calls Un Gran Maestro in Migromanzia, a great master of necromancy. Benvenuto tells the story of how Michael Scott predicted his own death. He foresaw, says Benvenuto, that he would be killed by the blow of a small stone of a certain weight, which would fall on his head. To ward off that fate, he took the precaution of wearing an iron helmet under his hat, as who wouldn't? But one day, when he came to a church just at the moment of the consecration, he removed his hat and his helmet to honour the Lord, or, in my opinion, adds Villani, so that he would not be noticed by the people, and not out of love of Christ, in whom he placed little faith. Well, there, a little stone fell on his bare head, scarcely scratching the skin. Michael picked up the stone, weighed it, and found it weighed just as much as the one he had foreseen. Certain that he would die, he disposed of his goods. And then he died of that wound. Of the many feats of magic he was reported to have performed, Benvenuto says they were potius ficta quam facta, more fiction than fact. Michael Scott features, or at least his corpse and his tomb feature, in Sir Walter Scott's first major work, the long poem Lay of the Last Minstrel. In a note to the poem, Scott tells us that Sir Michael Scott of Balwearie flourished during the 13th century. He was a man of much learning, chiefly acquired in foreign countries. He wrote a commentary upon Aristotle and several treatises upon philosophy, from which he appears to have been addicted to the abstruse studies of judicial astrology, alchemy, physiognomy, and chiromancy. Hence he passed among his contemporaries for a skillful magician. Dempster informs us that he remembers to have heard in his youth that the magic books of Michael Scott were still in existence, but could not be opened without danger on account of the malignant fiends who were thereby invoked. In the Lay of the Last Minstrel, William of Deloraine has to ride to Melrose Abbey in the eerie but romantic moonlight. And at 1 o'clock exactly, with the help of a withered, repentant monk, he opens Michael Scott's tomb and takes from it the dangerous book of magic required by the Lady of Branksome for her spells. Here's Walter Scott's famous description of the dead but undecayed body of Michael Scott. We're in the height of the Gothic movement. They open the tomb and an eerie light shines forth. I would you had been there to see how the light broke forth so gloriously, streamed upward to the chancel roof and through the galleries far aloof. No earthly flame blazed e'er so bright, it shone like heaven's own blessed light, and issuing from the tomb showed the monk's cowl and visage pale, danced on the dark-browed warrior's mail, and kissed the waving plume. Before their eyes the wizard lay, as if he had not been dead a day. His hoary beard in silver rolled, he seemed some 70 winters old. A palmer's amice or cloak wrapped him round, with a wrought Spanish baldric bound, like a pilgrim from beyond the sea. His left hand held his book of might, a silver cross was in his right, the lamp was placed beside his knee. High and majestic was his look, at which the fellest fiends had shook, and all unruffled was his face. They trusted his soul had gotten grace. That was from Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, to follow up after that brief reading from Sir Walter Scott's Lay of the Last Minstrel, part of our wee diversion about Michael Scott, the only Scotsman to appear in Dante's Inferno. And we're appearing here on Evening Under Lamplight, I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and this is Cambridge 105, and we're following Dante at the ditch of the sorcerers and magicians. And here's another magician.
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend Evening Under Lamplight. It's Cambridge 105. Community radio in your city.
Canto 20 concludes by bringing the list of magicians further up to date with a gathering of Italian astrologers, fortune tellers, and spellcasters. But come on, Virgil says, it's getting late. We have far to go. It's time to move on. And so they move on. They move on, but we linger for a little more, attending to what we've seen, playing around with the ideas and the images to see what they might open up for us. Obviously, this section of the Inferno has something to do with sorcery, with magic, wizardry, witchcraft, that sort of thing. But what exactly is this? Last time we saw the simoniacs, those people who had abused their holy offices for their own private gain. But these sorcerers abuse the whole foundation of the material world for their own gain. The simoniacs were topsy-turvy, topsy-turvy. The sorcerers are back to front. I said they abuse the material world, that is, the world that operates through cause and effect. We know about that. You hit a window with a stone and the window shatters, cause and effect. You eat the whole chocolate cake and you feel really bad in one way or another. You apply a match to a pile of dry leaves and you start a fire, cause and effect. But magicians circumvent that cause and effect process. The sorcerer raises his hand or his staff and the glass shatters all by itself. The witch performs some magical ceremony and without even having the pleasure of eating the chocolate cake, you find your guts gripped with terrible pain. The wizard stares intently at the pile of papers on the desk and they burst into flame. Forget for a moment the question of whether this is physically possible. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, let's put this into the context of the Inferno. Remember, we are here in the region of fraud. So what's fraudulent about this? First of all, these practitioners of magic are doing it for their own benefit, not, as Dante would wish, for the benefit of the community. I shatter your window or ruin your digestion or destroy your papers because perhaps I bear you a grudge. I use my magic to satisfy my own needs. That is, I exert my direct control over the material world to get what I want. This is a sin. It twists our relationship to the world around us, and thus we end up twisted ourselves. Can this really happen? I don't mean sleight-of-hand magic or illusionists, of course, but real magic. It's the stuff of imaginative literature, from Lord of the Rings to Harry Potter. But it also happens. And here's a true story, I promise, it's true. A real story of real sorcery that happened to me. Several years ago, I was in London with a student, walking down Shaftesbury Avenue, up near High Holborn, where those lovely plane trees are. A man stopped me to ask if I could give him change of a £20 note. He must have intuited that I was a good mark, someone who would innocently, naively stop and engage with him. I took out my wallet, which happened that day to have £80 cash in it, and took out two £10 notes. He took the notes and gave me the £20 note. And then it happened. There was a woman standing behind him, and she started singing or chanting, maybe out loud, maybe just aimed inside my head. I don't know. I didn't know because I was suddenly in a trance. Under their spell, I sort of froze. I was vaguely aware of my student a little to my side, but she seemed frozen too. Standing there with my wallet open in my hands, right there on Shaftesbury Avenue, I suddenly noticed the man's fingers slipping into one of the pockets of the wallet where I always keep a £20 note hidden away for emergencies, like you do. I woke up at that. "Hey, get out of here," I said. "Go into that shop and get change for your money if you're that desperate." And I gave him back the £20 note and I took my two £10 notes and walked away. Whew. A little later, I went to pay for something and opened my wallet where I found only the two £10 notes. What happened to the other £60? Could that man have... I cast my mind back to that scene, though it felt like I was struggling against something when I tried to return there, and I suddenly saw in my mind's eye a picture of that man swiping the three £20 notes from the wallet. I saw his hand take the notes away. In my mind's eye, I saw that I had been unable to respond to this theft in any way. I'd been robbed in broad daylight, and not by force, but by magic. Well, at least there was a good story to be told out of this, a story perhaps worth £60 to experience. And my student said that she had noticed nothing. Had she really been frozen too? Had this incident been wiped from her mind? And what was it that the woman was chanting? What kind of spell did she put on me? Whatever it was real.
I put a spell on you. Because you're mine. Stop the things you do. What's up? I ain't lying. Yeah, I can't stand. Woo! No running around. I can't stand. Oh, no putting me down. I put a spell on you.
That chorus was Screamin' Jay Hawkins, "I Put a Spell on You." He put a spell on her because he says, "I want you." But this wizard on Shaftesbury Avenue did not want me, just my money, like all fraudsters. Apparently, Jay Hawkins, a blues singer, went in to record "I Put a Spell on You" as a normal blues ballad. But as he tells us, the producer, these are his words, the producer brought in ribs and chicken and got everybody drunk, and we came out with this weird version. I don't even remember making the record. Before, I was just a normal blues singer. I was just Jay Hawkins. It all sort of just fell in place. I found out I could do more destroying a song and screaming it to death. The stage act in which he performed this song in full costume with props like a skull smoking a cigarette was, I'm told, the first example of what came to be known as shock rock. But I think it's so innocent in its excitement with playing with destroying a song that he's not going to be in hell anyway. At least not for this. I don't know anything else. But let's get back to these sorcerers in Canto 20 of the Inferno. Many, though not all, of them here seem to be condemned for predicting the future. But obviously, they're predicting the future fraudulently for the wrong purposes, or they wouldn't be there. Perhaps they really couldn't predict the future, but just impressed people that they could, and that's fraud after all. Dante isn't clear about whether they could truly predict or not, but perhaps they could. Dante, as Chip, in now living in London for a bit, as Chip told me, Dante would have known Augustine's claim that these sorcerers gained their powers by communicating with demons. And then suppose they really could see into the future. It seems that these figures here just used that power to gain influence and wealth from those who needed to know what was coming up. The point is that once again, we see the ego trying to control the world rather than cooperating with it. Some people condemn all seeing into the future. Que sera, sera, the future is not ours to see. Or as the Latin poet Horace puts it, tu ne quaesieris, scira nefas, quem mihi, quem tibi, finem dederint. You should not seek what ends the gods will give us. Scira nefas. To play around with this sort of thing is sinful. You notice, don't you, that we're trying to fulfill our role as the erudite show on our community radio station, living up to the high learning or pedantry Cambridge is known for. So far on this show, we've had Italian, Scots, Spanish, sort of. Que sera, sera is actually only imitation Spanish, a bit of French, Symphonie Fantastique, after all, and Latin. Also, if you noticed, the word shtup, a Yiddish word for what Zeus was doing to all the women he saw. But though we may play around with pedantry here on Evening Under Lamplight, we do it lightly, I hope, and for fun, not to impress. What do I need to impress you for? Actually, I'm really quite illiterate when it comes down to it. I throw in these little pieces of learning here only to share, not to show off, you know that. But now, to return to our point. Surely not everyone who sees into the future will be found in hell. There are prophets, for instance, who foretell the workings of divine providence. The word prophet means someone who speaks out. Contrast this with the sorcerers in hell whose twisted necks prevent them from saying any words. There are soothsayers who say sooth or truth. And there are shamans who can see into the future. But unless they have been corrupted somehow, they use their powers for the good of the community and to heal others. They operate far beyond the ego. It's called magic or sinful sorcery if you're doing it for yourself. If you're doing it for a higher cause, then it's working miracles. Or if not working miracles, in the material world, healing the sick, for instance, the sorcerer can move in a different direction. The example of this is Prospero, the hero of Shakespeare's final play, The Tempest. Just as Shakespeare had spent his career working the magic of his stagecraft, so Prospero has dedicated his life to all sorts of magic, even while exiled on a desert island with only his daughter for company. Like Michael Scott, Prospero has his book of magic, and he has various other magical accessories, including Ariel, a sprite who carries out the practical work of achieving the magical effects. And then, when his enemies come within reach, Prospero magics up a storm, the tempest of the title, to wreck his enemy's ship and bring them under his control on the island. Prospero has his own inner tempest seeking revenge, but At the climax of the play, his magic sprite awakens his compassion for the fellow human beings, and Prospero repents. If you could see your enemy's sorry state now, Ariel tells Prospero, your affections would become tender. Dost thou think so, spirit? Prospero replies, and Ariel says, mine would, sir, were I human. And then the magic moment of metanoia, or twisting around. My affections would become tender if I were human, says Ariel, and Prospero says, and mine shall. No more revenge, but forgiveness instead. And the magic? Prospero relieves himself of it, throwing off his magic cloak, burying his book, breaking his staff. These things are not necessary to be a full human being. And he returns to the material world of being merely human, vulnerable and limited in his abilities to control the world around him. But, we've learned, able to control the tempest within himself. Now my charms are all o'erthrown, he says. And what strength I have's mine own, which is most faint. If magic does not help us to become more human, then it's sinful and twists us in the wrong way, wringing out our eternal tears.
Must be here, come find.
That was Lorena McKennitt's eerie rendition of Prospero's speech, the epilogue to Shakespeare's Tempest, the epilogue to his entire career too, we might say, the heavenly end of magic. And let's not confuse these fortune tellers who use supernatural powers to see into the future with scientists who study the cause and effect patterns to predict how things are likely to go in the future. Take this aspirin and your headache will be relieved soon in the future. Keep up all this fracking and you're going to experience even more devastating earthquakes. And of course, there are the weather forecasters who use very sophisticated scientific tools to analyze the patterns of air and water to foretell what kind of weather we'll have tomorrow. Yes, of course, they're not always accurate. But that's not because it's a false science or sinful magic. It's because the material they're working with is so extremely complicated. And then again, very often you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. But then there are other kinds of non-scientific reading of the future, astrology, tarot readings, and so on. There's no time to say much about them now, but when we connect with true astrologers and fortune tellers, not the ones who offer horoscopes light or who lure you into their reading rooms with promises to answer all your anxieties. But true fortune tellers will be sure to say that they never predict the future. They look for the ways our present state resonates with astrological or tarot or other patterns in the world in a way that is called synchronicity. In other words, they provide us images that, over the centuries, have proved themselves, when approached in the right spirit, proved themselves to provide insight into how we are right now, and through that insight offer some clues to what might happen in the future if we keep on our present course. These people are serving others. They're not hell-bent. They're not twisted, but I think we can say they face us straight on. And that takes us to the last point I wanted to make here. The sinners Dante shows us are not just walking backwards, but they're also mute. They cannot talk, only weep. And their backwardness and silence, are they connected in some way? Well, think about how we speak to others. When we speak to others, don't we, or shouldn't we, face them? If we turn part of ourselves backwards, we're not fully present to the other person. Maybe, as in the case of many of these sinners, we appear to be facing the luckless client, but we're really turned towards our bank account instead. And twisted in this way, we may be uttering words, but our speech is not really there. It's just words, not full of shit like flatterers, but simply vapid and empty, full of pain and weeping. So these sorcerers, who try to get around the natural laws of the material universe, they find themselves never present in the real world. Maybe they really can see the future, but it is of no good if they can't also see the present, which is the only true reality we have. In fact, being in such a state, these sinners are like all the other sinners in the Inferno who can see dimly the past and future up in the living world, but cannot see what is going on right now. It seems, Dante is telling us, that one of the dire and woeful consequences of living in the ego is that we can no longer attend to the real things of life, the only things that can engage and enliven our heart and spirit. It's really nice to be able to wave your magic wand and have the dishes all wash themselves. But there's a special joy, as perhaps you too have discovered, a special joy in actually handling the dishes ourselves and getting our hands wet and soapy and performing the rhythmic dance of cleansing one item after another until finally we experience the satisfaction of a job well done. And that, after all, is why we attend to anything. And why, I hope, you've been attending and attending to this evening's Evening Under Lamplight with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, on Cambridge 105. It's time to go now. See you again in a fortnight. And we'll go out with Miles Davis, the Sorcerer. Of course.
Mm-hmm.